Hi there, I'm Atul, and I'm very, very excited because this is the one of the first ever Twitter live stream mass chat, and it's quite literally a chat. And one of my visions is we are bringing Twitter is a very powerful platform for our maths teachers because quite a lot of us are on there already. But the maths chat is mostly in sort of text form, whereas as an online teacher, I teach online all the time, so this is very close to my world where the interactions are live on video, on a whiteboard, or even like another camera using manipulatives. So yeah, I'd like to kick things off, and I'm really, really excited to have on here. It's no exaggeration to say one of my absolute role models, someone I've learned phenomenal amounts from over the last 3 years. I've gone to quite a lot of the training days that he runs, I've been to like seven or eight of them, a full 1 day training courses, and there's so much that I've learned, and there's so much I could learn, and there's so much that there could be in this live stream. So we'll try and compress it down to, as I should try and call it, the greatest hits. So we've got Mark with us, who's been a maths teacher, a head off at a school, Ofsted inspector, ran the NCETM, and currently runs the largest network of maths teachers, LaSalle Education. So welcome, Mark, and let's kick off.
Hi, Atom. Thanks for asking me on. It's all very odd. Not really sure what we're doing here, but hopefully some people are listening. Did you want me to do a bit
Yes,
more than intro?
so this is a very sort of live experience, and I've got some questions that I can ask. I've got some of my favorite ones, and then there's some questions coming in as well. So we've got so if it's a public profile like Twitter, I'll just mention the name since it's public anyway. K-Red has asked a really, really important question at the moment. Let's be honest, we are all staying at home for very, very important reasons. We have our social responsibility right now. And K-Red is asking, what are the key challenges facing staff once we return, and how can we best support each other?
It's probably the most important question around at the moment, I guess. And it's interesting to see how schools are reacting at the moment, and very naturally reacting in a way of children are away from school, we must concentrate on provision. And some schools are pulling that off really well. But this online learning, home learning, distance learning, it's a pretty complex thing to get right. It's not easy to get right at all. And schools are doing their absolute best to put in place provision at the moment. That provision for the majority of teachers will be suboptimal to the way they work. It doesn't fit into their pedagogies. It's not something they're used to. They've had very, very little time to prepare. And yet all of the energy is going in now. And I wonder if a better use of the majority of our energy just now would be accepting that children are away from school at the moment. There is so much that we can do for them. There are people doing amazing things online with lessons, live streaming, and schools have sent so many resources home to for children to use and so on, and parents are trying their best. But I wonder if a better use of our energy is say, okay, so that's the current situation. Let's divert our energy into thinking about what is about to be, I would suggest, the single most important academic year, maybe ever, that children are going to have missed a substantial amount of time en masse. The gap between the most advantaged and the most disadvantaged in that time will widen and widen and widen because, of course, those who can are putting in provision for their children. So for me, I think the thing to do is to focus on when we return and what we need to achieve there. And I think that what we need to achieve is an accelerated year. So we're going to maybe have the same length of academic year, maybe not, but probably. How do we ensure that a 14-year-old, an 8-year-old, a 17-year-old, how do we ensure that their education, even though they were part of this cohort that had this very strange thing happen to them, how do we ensure their education gets them to the same outcome as it should have done? or even how do we get to a better outcome than it possibly would have done? And I would suggest the single most important ingredient in whether children get the best deal is teacher quality. So at the moment, we have this period of time, teachers are kind of in limbo for much of their time, working really hard to provide materials. But what if instead we use this time for teachers to develop their own practices, develop their own subject knowledge, develop their own pedagogies? And in particular, if you want to have an accelerated year, if we want to be able to get children through an academic year learning far more than they potentially would have learned in a standard year, then for me that's all about curriculum and making sure that when they come back, they hit the ground running with more expert teachers because they've dedicated that time to learning more about subject knowledge and content and pedagogical content knowledge. But then they have a program designed to take them rapidly through learning. And I think that a very good use of time at the moment would be spending a lot of time on ensuring that your curriculum is absolutely spot on or as close to spot on as you can get it in these months for every single child. I've spoken many times in the past about curriculum, and I'm not talking about having a year 7 curriculum and every year 7 child follows that. I'm not talking about having a year 10 curriculum and every year 10 child follows that. I'm talking about thinking about every single child and making sure that you work out very, very quickly, you work out where they're truly at, what they've gripped, what things have been forgotten. Lots will have been forgotten. Lots of things will have slipped away, and that's okay. It's perfectly normal and natural. But working out where they're at, where they're truly at, where their foundational base is, and then very rapidly building on that base. I think that question is, I'd sum up the answer to that question is, what could we do? What should we be doing? Is get a really, really, really sound curriculum in place and use this time to get as many of your staff upskilled as possible and related to that curriculum. So if you put a curriculum in place and you're planning on addressing certain areas of mathematics, concentrate your CPD now on those areas of mathematics and how best to communicate meaning, how best to get children to meaning make, how best to take people on very quickly. It's going to be an incredible challenge, and this coming academic year can't be the case that what we do now is put in suboptimal provision and then come back in September, October and say, and now we're just going to have a normal academic year. That just can't be what we do. If we do that, then every single child that's in a school at the moment doesn't get the deal they were supposed to get from school. So we know that the provision at the moment is suboptimal for lots and lots of reasons, which means the new year has to be exceptional. So curriculum planning and curriculum planning and curriculum planning. That's what I'd suggest we're doing.
Like never before, actually, because it's just exceptional circumstances. And what I'm seeing from the maths teaching community on Twitter is this, at the moment, there's just a rush to keep things as they were in whichever way we can. But what I'm getting from you is we almost have to pull back from that and look ahead and think, actually, there is going to be a hit, as you're saying, some people, they're going to go back to school a lot later. The disadvantaged ones simply won't get the extra help or any help at all. So they'll go back several months of not doing any maths whatsoever. And then they've got to go back straight in with a limited amount of time and play catch up. So we're better off spending this time training curriculum design rather than kind of scramble onto this online teaching. I teach online all the time, and it's taken me thousands of hours to learn that. I'm not kidding. It's a very, very, it's a very intricate thing to do. It's actually very difficult. And you've got to be both good with technology and teaching and putting the two together. So I totally get what you're saying there.
Yeah, it has a completely different pedagogy, completely different set of practices, and competencies, and we're asking a huge number of teachers to suddenly have those practices. And teachers do what they always do. They, you know, in the same way that we fix leaking roofs, teachers will respond to situations and they'll do their bloody best to make sure that the children get as good a deal as possible. But the reality is this is happening. Children are at home, lives are disrupted, families are disrupted. The conditions for learning are not optimal. And the quicker the professions say, okay, there is a period of time where the conditions for learning are not optimal, so the thing we must do is ensure that the period when we get children back is exceptional. The quicker the profession do that, the better, because then we can get into the really hard work of curriculum planning, task planning, resource planning, upskilling teachers, getting teachers ready for very specific types of very specific pieces of teaching. And you know, this is a really odd time, but maybe what we could do here is use this in a way that we've never had the time to stop and think and breathe. You know, as working in school is hectic, finding the time to truly think deeply about curriculum planning, it's very, very rare. And I think we should probably use that. Also, yeah, and this is I guess very personal point of view, and maybe people will shoot me down for it as well, but maybe in these months there are more important things than learning maths, right? You know, maybe there are more important things going on in people's lives and family lives. And you know, what if at home you said, okay, so you've got these resources that are being sent to you and you can do some activities and whatever, but actually, why not use the next 3 months to learn how to play an instrument? Or, you know, why not use the next 3 months to, I don't know, learn a new craft? Why not use the next few months to get to know your family really well? I think that the pressures on home life are being largely underestimated, not by teachers get it because you've got 30 kids in the room with you hour after hour, but generally in society I think it's being underestimated how bloody hard it is to suddenly have children at home, your work life disrupted, having to, you know, everyone's dotted around the houses in different rooms trying to work from home, or some people are having to go out to work, and then all the stress and anxiety that brings with it. Maybe the next 3 months could be just family time. How bad would that be? And if by it being family time, and if by it being, you know, wouldn't it be great if you were 13 and you could spend 3 months learning the guitar? I'd have loved that when I was 13. You know, what if we said, actually, we'll do our best, we'll give you what we can give you, but realistically, there's not a schooling happening at the moment. And it's probably not the most important thing in your life. Because if we did do that rapidly, then the teaching profession could say, so what should we do? What should we focus on? And then they could focus on the preparation for the new year, which I think is far, far more important than trying to put in place provision at the moment. Far more important. And those in, you know, particularly the most disadvantaged in society, and what they have access to, and the gulf that's going to open up between the most advantaged and most disadvantaged during this time, get ready for it. Get ready for getting them back in September and lifting them up in a way that you've never lifted them up before. And that requires planning and creating of tasks and thinking through, role-playing through, how am I going to take those specific children and teach them rapidly and get them to a point where they should be. It's probably not a very popular view that maybe education, maybe schooling is not the most important thing on people's minds at the moment. You know, there are other things, there are other parts of education. Yeah. We have whatever, 10 subjects, and we say these 10 subjects are important. But there are lots of other things that can be learned that have nothing to do with the school curriculum. Why not take this really odd circumstance to go and learn one of those? You know, you might want to learn how to play the piano, you might want to learn how to be a computer programmer, you might want to learn how to turn some wood to create a bowl. You know, why not?
As long as they're 2 meters away from everyone else, except for their family.
Yeah. Well, you know, you can compute the program and be 1,000 miles away from the person that's teaching you. And I've seen people playing in bands online, doing gigs, you know, where people are in different parts of the country and stuff.
Yeah.
That's what I'd be doing if I was a teenager. I'd be getting the guitar out and spending my time doing that.
I mean, the reason we are doing this on Twitter, in fact, like this, is it's a platform called Periscope, and it was designed by musicians nearly like 5-6 years ago, this live streaming business. So this video technology that we haven't really used in education as much is actually from the musicians. So I've used this in live streaming and my own music stuff, and you can route your sound card to the computer, etc. But just coming back to maths again, it is a controversial answer, because all of us as maths teachers are extremely anxious, because we had for like someone like someone who's teaching their year 11s or year 13s, the world has changed for them. Like, you know, like no one really knows what's going on. Ofqual have like a broad set of guidelines on how to assess them, but it's quite difficult to sort of just accept that that's what's going to happen. And in some ways we feel helpless, because we are giving people and we want to make sure we keep educating our children. But you know, I understand, because I work so much one-on-one with parents, I'm getting frazzled parents that are home, and they're getting assignment after assignment being sent to the children, and they don't really know how to homeschool. They don't know how to process what the assignment is asking of and what it means in the long term. And believe it or not, Mark, I've had like one parent just ask me, because we were doing stuff and somehow fractions came up, and you're probably gonna have a knee-jerk reaction to this, and the parent said, well, the child's been told the denominator is always bigger than the numerator, and they're using fractions teach up to pizza slices to use fractions. So I've been covering it using quiz and error, so I've had to just tell parents, actually the reason why I'm doing what I'm doing is based on all this mastery stuff, and by Mark McCourt's book, and from page this to this talks why you don't use fractions and what's the right way to do it is, and you've got the quiz and error, etc. But you know, that's a really difficult thing for a parent to understand and implement.
Yeah, it's an impossible ask, and I'm not sure why we would be asking that. We're either serious about teaching is a very complex, difficult thing to do, which is why it's a profession and it takes a long time to be really good at it, and actually subject-specific pedagogy and subject-specific content knowledge and knowing children and knowing what learning is and how learning works are important and complex and intellectual things. We're either serious about that, or we're saying anyone with 5 minutes prep and a worksheet sent at them can just pull it off. It's bonkers, right? I mean, could you imagine if some other industry or some other part of the public sector had closed, and then every parent across the country was told, now you have to do that at home with your children or whatever, you know? That's not how professions work. They're complex. We're asking a ridiculous thing of parents to suddenly know how to deliver subjects. And also, by asking that, you know, if we're saying to parents, here's a bunch of stuff, just teach kids, would you? Without any preparation, without any help for them. What we're really saying is that teaching is not a hard thing. And teaching is a hard thing, a really, really bloody hard thing to get right. I completely understand the position that a lot of parents are taking, saying, well, maybe I'll do the things I'm really good at doing with my children during this time. Maybe I'll up that, you know. A friend of mine's teaching their child survival skills. But, you know, it's just because it's their area of expertise, but you know. And I know several people where their children are out. Oh, Christ, probably get... Hang on, make sure I don't get anyone arrested here. But I know several people where their children are out working the farm. And, you know, why not? Again, if I was a teenager, I'd love to be... If something like this had happened and my parents said, well, come and work on the farm for a bit. Yeah, great. Love that. And why not learn those things? They're important things to learn.
Great. You can check on your mobile phone as well. So I'm just like looking at the notifications as they come in. I'll ask some questions. We've got Colin Watts asking, how can teachers avoid merely presenting rather than teaching when working remotely?
Yeah, good question, Colin. And it's kind of what Atul was just kind of touching on there, where online tutoring has a pedagogy. It has a set of skills, a set of ways of working with pupils online, and they're complex to build up. It's not my area of expertise. Atul's much more expert at this than me. But you know, when he was, you started to talk there, Atul, about trying to explain to parents how to use, say, quiz and error odds to communicate fractionness. Doing that sort of interaction with pupils, working with them, then being able to see what you're doing so they can kind of see what you're interacting with and talking about whilst they're doing it, and you being able to see what they're doing so that you can be, you know, you can be that one-to-one tutor responding, changing, tweaking everything that you're doing, listening to what they're saying, getting them to narrate out loud. You quite often see, well, maybe not so much nowadays because people are getting better at it, but certainly a lot of online tuition used to be, I'll tell you something and then I'll just go off for a bit and then you do a bunch of questions. So there's no responsiveness, there's no actual teaching going on. And when I see that sort of thing, I think, well, why didn't you just watch a YouTube video? Yeah. Wouldn't that have been better? I mean, you could have paused it and watched it at your own time and pace. If you're going to do online teaching, it should be online teaching. It should be the same quality and the same kind of thing that's going on in the classroom. And that's about that responsiveness. But Colin's right, you see a lot of presentation, a heck of a lot of presentation. And I always think, just watch YouTube. You'd be better off, and you won't have to pay someone 50 quid or whatever, you know, you just go and watch a video. But if you want to be taught and you want an expert and you want someone to actually respond to your thinking during that learning happening there and then in the moment, then you need a proper online teacher. And yeah, it should be exactly like a classroom, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one good thing is that for self-learners, if all the stuff's out there, actually, just like this whole flip learning thing, you can just go on Corbett Maths and he's produced over 300 videos with the worksheets. But if you want the live experience, that's what I do, basically. And that's extremely, extremely intricate, actually. You know, all the things I've learned from you, I've applied to online tutoring, which is like on the whiteboard, you present the information in a very carefully phased way. You don't want cognitive load. You want to make sure you just present the right information at the right time. You don't talk and write at the same time. So I've seen, I don't know how to phrase it as well, like another controversial one, but I've seen online tutoring being made a meal of more than it has ever been, in higher numbers than ever it has ever been, actually, just because everyone scrambled onto it. And I don't know what to say. It depresses me, but
The reality is that the vast majority of online tutoring is total shit, right? I mean, it's absolute garbage. And finding people who can do it really well is hard. You know, the whole thing of online tutoring, what does that mean? Is it some kind of independent learning thing? Like you say, just go watch John Corbett videos if you want to do independent learning. And then you get to listen to John's dulcet Irish tones as well. You know, it's a much better deal. But that whole online tutoring, it being some kind of digital provision, it belittles what it is when people do it really well. Because really, when people do it really well, all you're getting is a teacher. Someone is teaching you. And it's not a tutoring thing. They're not students. They're not going off and studying independently. The teacher is responding to them in real time, tweaking their plans, tweaking their instructions, tweaking everything they're doing. In the same way that, you know, when you're in the classroom, you go between the desks. The reason you go between the desks is to hear conversations, to spot things that they write, nuances in the way one child responds to instruction compared to another, and then you tweak that and you do correctives live and in the moment. So I think, you know, if it's done really well, it's just a classroom and you're getting a teacher. Done really badly, as Colin's saying, it's someone just presenting stuff at you. And you'd be better off watching Corbett Maths. You know, it's, for a start, the instruction will be higher quality if you go and watch some of John's videos anyway. Yeah. And then you can, if you want to do independent learning, it's a very different thing, independent learning. That's a very, very different, you know, that's the child then being a student. They are studying, they're taking it upon themselves to take themselves through the course material and learn and source the instruction. Whereas online teaching is just really good teaching. Anyway.
Questions are starting to come in. It's fantastic. So, like, if you're on Twitter right now, please do ask us questions. Anything that comes up as a result of this conversation, retweet this tweet so it's on my timeline, so you can see it. This is brand new technology. We're using it for Maths Chat. My other vision is we can keep doing this online. At the very least, we can have other maths teachers continue our CPD. I've got a bunch of knowledge in doing all of this stuff online. This is, in some ways, it's kind of my life. So I'm very happy to contribute my knowledge in whichever way I can. So Chris McGrain's asking, is this going to be available as a recording on Twitter? Absolutely, it's there. Just watch it as many times as you want. Unless you want me to delete it. Unless we can do that as well. If it's really controversial, we can remove it. So John Peterson's asking, again, a very similar question to what you've answered already. How do we go about closing the huge disadvantage gap that this period away from school will create?
And it's kind of what obsesses me. My entire reason for coming into education was for those people who are most disadvantaged. The answer, John, is probably it's not possible to close the gap. I'm also not entirely sure it is either necessary or desirable to close the gap. When you see examples of that happening where the gap closes, you know, so there is no gap between most advantaged and most disadvantaged, you look around the world and you find examples of that happening in history, it's usually because, you know, here's the most disadvantage, it's usually because what we did is we brought the most advantage down. I don't really have any interest in bringing any pupil backwards. But probably what John's really talking about is, you know, we do have this massive gap. How do we narrow that gap? How do we get the disadvantage lifted up as much as we possibly can? You've got the situation at the moment where just shy of 25% of all children have a private maths tutor. And what's really fascinating about that, so you've got 73 quarters of the population don't have a private maths tutor. And what's fascinating about that group is when you survey those parents, over 50% of those parents want to have a private maths tutor. And the reason they quote is because they can't afford it, right? So it's not that there's not a desire for that to happen, but people do want to lift their children up, do want to give them, you know, the most educational experience that they possibly can. But they're simply locked out of it. They don't have the ability to get access to that kind of learning. So one of the things we're doing at the moment is we've just introduced, for our network, we've just introduced a whole series of free tuition for any child who would be considered disadvantaged. Schools can decide what that means. We've got no particular interest in saying here are the circumstances teachers know who is disadvantaged and who is not educationally. And sometimes it has to do with wealth, but quite often it doesn't. Quite often it's to do with neglect. So that's one of the things we're doing. We're putting in place this access to free tuition. There's a huge amount of stuff, you know, we're just talking about Corbett Maths, for example. There's a huge amount of stuff out there that's available for free and you can access it. Not free, John's paid for it, you know, over many years himself. But it's good that it's up there and people can get to it. There was a Mintel report not very long ago that we're nearly at saturation now. So aged 18 to age 15, 98% of children have access to the internet at home. And what's interesting about that Mintel report is that the proportion of children who do not have access to the internet at home isn't where you think it would be. It's not in the poorest families. Of course, there are families that are poor and don't have access, but it's not a characteristic of them. So generally, children do have access to the internet at home. Fine, loads of them will wind you up and tell you they don't have access to it and they don't have access to devices. But, you know, Mintel's one of the largest surveys that gets carried out, and the data is pretty strong and has been growing year on year on year. So we do know that children have access to that. Do they have access to a safe place to learn, a quiet place to listen to new materials, somewhere to engage in things? Do they have, because these are far more important things than the technology, because almost everyone has the technology now, but do they have access to parents who say, you know, learning's a good thing, you should be doing that. It's something we'd be proud of you if you go off and do that. Do they have the ability to just have time in their day where they're able to often learn without other pressures in their life? These are far more important things and hugely complex things to try to solve. Loads of people are doing what they can to address that. But it's a really tough thing to do. You know, I always saw my job when I was in schools. I always saw my job as a big part of it was inculcating a belief in the parents that learning matters. If you win that battle, if you get parents, they don't have to be able to help. They don't have to know how to solve a simultaneous equation. They don't have to be able to. They don't even have to care too much about the subject, right? And they don't have to be particularly interested. But if they are saying to their children regularly, I'm so proud of you for learning whatever it is, you know, who cares what it is? So proud of you for learning that. Or if they're continually saying to their children, oh, it's amazing that you know this stuff. If they're continually saying to their children, I'm so happy that you've engaged in school more than I did, you know, those sorts of things, getting parents to have those kind of dispositions and thoughts is really important. You know, there are very, very tough situations going on in some households. I used to be, in an old life, I was a child protection officer, and some of the things that we all know goes on in the home, these are really, really complex things to try to address. And when those children are in school, maybe the hours that they come to school, maybe they're there 8 hours or whatever, or you have a breakfast club or an evening club or whatever, maybe they're there longer. For a lot of children, that's the only black and white in their entire day. That is the only place with structure, the only place where someone is reaching into their life and saying, you matter. Your input into this great game that is humanity, it matters. And we want to get something out of you. And now what we've done is necessarily switch that off for a lot of people. Schools and children's centers are open across the UK. And where possible, those that are in the hardest circumstances are still able to come and be with teachers. But a lot of people that has been switched off for, and a lot of people that only structure that they had has gone. So I would go back to my answer earlier that we have to be cognizant that that has happened, and that when they return to school, there's a deficit there. There's something really, really severe has happened to those children. So we have to have an exceptional year, a really, really exceptional year. And that's same answer as early, that's preparing for it right now, being mindful of what's actually going on, what the reality is for lots of our children, and preparing for it now, and then lifting them up as quickly as we possibly can. I know some schools, some educators, some head teachers who are reaching into communities, you know, and we know who these children are that are in these terrible circumstances. But that will only have so much impact. So be aware we're having limited impact, and then get ready to mitigate it when we have access to them again.
So Catherine's got a really good follow-up question from that. She says, at Arithmetics, we met her at various math cons. You mentioned an accelerated year. What would that look like? Just a very practical question.
Yeah, I've spoken about this many times. It's kind of one of my obsessions. We know that children can learn at pace. That time after time after time in over history in different jurisdictions around the world, in different cultures and different systems, we have been able to show that children can learn at pace. Almost all children, if you know. So I'm going to be talking here about pretty much every child that exists, apart from the tiniest fraction of children with the most severe learning needs. And you know, we put in place provision for those. We try to do as best we can, but other than that group, pretty much everyone can learn at pace, and pretty much everyone can grip new ideas and meaning make and assimilate them into their current schema of understanding and knowledge. So an accelerated year would be moving at pace with them. So really the question to ask, which is why I think using this couple of months for preparation and planning is so important, really the question to ask is, why is it they don't learn at pace? And they don't learn at pace because, you know, lots of reasons, but the biggest reason by far, they don't learn at pace because the ideas that are being presented to them, the ideas that are being communicated to them, are not at the right level for those individual children. Now, when you're learning something that is just beyond your current understanding, you know, you can make logical steps to it, it makes sense, it can be assimilated, it fits into your current thinking, you can learn quickly. If someone is trying to teach you something miles ahead of where you are, you're not going to grip that. So you know, I'm sure people have heard me, some people have heard me talk in the past about a conveyor belt system that we have, and that's the culprit. The reason we don't fix the conveyor belt system, the reason there is a you know, bloody situation in England where there is a year 4 scheme of work, there is a year 7 scheme of work, there is a year 10 scheme of work, and no matter what you know or what you don't know, you follow that scheme of work. One of the reasons we have that situation is because we don't get time to stop, think, breathe, and look at curriculum planning seriously and carefully. And maybe now is the chance where we could do that. Maybe we could say, you know, so I've got a year 5 class starting in September. I know the distribution roughly of where those children are at and what they know and what they don't know. How do I put in place a course such that all of those children are being expected to learn things just beyond their current understanding, rather than having this normal distribution idea of a conveyor belt where I teach something to the middle and then everyone else is just floundering. So when I'm talking about an accelerated year, Catherine, what I'm really saying is, take the time now to plan for a year where every child in every cohort is following a curriculum that is targeted at them and not a general curriculum that is, you know, you're aged 11, so you must all learn the nth term of the sequence. It's okay that some aged 11-year-olds learn nth term of the sequence, but it's also okay that some 11-year-olds, because they have been missed on the conveyor belt in previous years. It's also okay that some 11-year-olds are learning how to number 1 to 10. And it's also okay that some 11-year-olds are learning the quadratic formula. These things are all okay because those children are different and they learn at different speeds and they meaning make from different examples and models and metaphors. So get in place a curriculum ready for all of those. And that's, you know, what we're doing at the moment with, we have all these member schools and, you know, obviously we can help them with home learning and provision as much as is practical. But really what we're concentrating on for the next few months is really hammering curriculum design, really hammering courses and making sure that classes are able to follow courses that will lift them all up. So right. That's what I mean by that.
That's great. That's very good.
Because I'm really talking about, I don't want it to be misconstrued that I'm saying I want you to, I think schools should do the same thing but faster. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that all children can learn at pace if we do things differently. If we take this mastery approach, if we take this responsive cycle approach, if we get rid of a conveyor belt approach, all children can learn at pace. And we need to ready ourselves, because we now have, for the first time ever, maybe, we now have the collective breathing space to think about the curriculum. We need to ready ourselves with an amazing curriculum to take them all forward. Anyway, I'm ranting slightly. Get me into ranting stage in a minute.
No, this is building perfectly to one thing I really, really personally want to see. I'd love to see the mathematical universe and how that just to get into specifics of it. You know, what does it mean to do this topic? What does it mean for one person to learn this topic at that speed? How the whole thing is, because we sort of have this as teachers in our head, this mathematical universe that you showed our YouTube video of. So that, you know, I'd love to see that, but before we get into it, I'm just gonna ask for I'm just gonna put a couple of other questions. Some are very obviously are related to what's happening now, and you've answered them, so everyone can always watch the video later on. So Mark's, if you tuned in late, Mark's answered quite a few questions already that are coming up commonly. Andy Parkinson's asked a question, and Neil Armand asked it first, so very simple one. How can we best support children in early years, year one, with maths during this time? Because of the age, online lessons are just not desirable.
I wouldn't. You're five. Enjoy your family.
Learn
Enjoy
guitar.
Your family. Yeah, absolutely. Five-year-old, why not? Play, be happy, you know. The important thing is that we put in place now structures and systems and curricula such that when children come back, we can really go for it. Five-year-old, six-year-old, play, have fun, get to know your parents better, or parent, get to know your child better. Encourage them, try and instill in them just a general love of learning. You know, if you embark on what I'm going to try to do is try and teach the early year. A comment was this question about early year goals.
From what I can interpret, it is basically how can we support those children, because we can't teach them online because they're just too young to be taught online. So that's simple.
Yeah, don't teach them online, for Christ's sake. You know, just let them be children. Encourage their parents. If you want to do something, you know, if you've got the capacity and you can reach into families' homes with online tutoring, do it in the evening with the parents. Don't try and set up a lesson during the day to put reception and year one children on. This bonkers. Have a session in the evening where you get some parents together and you say, here would be some really good songs to sing with your children, here would be some really good activities to do with your children throughout the day. And there can be all sorts of things. Go out into the garden and pick up a leaf and talk to them about the symmetry on the leaf, or sing a song about repeating patterns of color. Take a load of stickle bricks and put them on the floor, and then say, I've made a pattern, red, blue, green. Can you make a pattern? What might the next one be? And if you do have the ability to reach into families' homes through things like Zoom, and you're thinking about 5 and 6, 7 and 8 year olds, you have much greater impact by having sessions with the parents rather than with the children. Because if those parents in this time could more and more instill a general love of learning in those children, then that'll help you in this accelerated year that we need to have, because they'll be curious. Children are curious anyway. So have some sessions with parents about how to really drive your child's curiosity, how to get them asking questions, being curious about things, wondering, wanting to know more. Yeah, how do you respond as a parent, right? Because you've got a five-year-old, and maybe you've got a two-year-old and a one-year-old as well, and you're bloody knackered and you're trying to do your job and you've got sick down you, and you still have to drag up from somewhere in you when the child says, you know, hey, I've done this. You still have to be able to drag up the energy to go, that's amazing, brilliant, tell me more about it. Or when your child has asked you why about something for the 100th time, having the resilience to keep going with that why and not saying, you know, this conversation's over. These would be more important things to do. Get them to play, get them to be curious, and you know, build patterns, all sorts of things you could do with things just around the house. You don't need anything to do this. There are patterns on the floors that, you know, you can make patterns out of taking boxes from the groceries and saying, can you put these, which one of these is bigger, and put them in order of size, and getting them to do trades with their siblings, like how many cars are you going to trade for a tractor, all that kind of stuff. But the idea of, I'm gonna really annoy some people by saying this, because I know people are trying to do this at the moment. The idea of doing online learning, you know, trying to have a timetable for 5-year-olds and then deliver lessons over the internet, I just think it's wrong. Let them play, let them be children, and then get ready for them coming back.
Yeah, I mean, I have such community due to the thing I do tutoring. I still keep them like as evening slots. I'm seeing frazzled parents, so teaching is extremely complex, and it's a thing of its own. Lots of questions coming in, and people are talking to each other. So this is fantastic, Mark. We've got conversation going on. This is really what was part of my vision. But yeah, just kind of, I'd love to see the demo of the mathematical universe, and then we can get some more questions based on that. I know you've done a video already, and it's out there. We'll plug that one as well. And like with any kind of learning, accelerated learning as well, it's all based, you know, around that mastery, that mathematical universe. You could give us some context of how that fits in here.
Yeah. Yeah, okay, let me try and make this work.
Yeah, it's just share screen on your Zoom. That's it, yeah, it's going already. Fantastic. And if you just unmute your video so we can see. It's on the bottom.
Is it on?
Your video is gone, but I can see the screen. Which?
My video back?
Yep, you're back, and the mathematical universe is there, and I'm there as well. So,
okay, this is very disconcerting because all I can see is this browser tab. I can't see me.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, really, I'm not sure what we should do with this just now at all. It'd probably be better if you ask questions and I try to respond to them.
Sure.
But just very briefly, for people that don't know about it, this is a curriculum we've been building for the last 16 years that forms this mathematical, I call it a universe because it has this spherical shape to it, and I quite like this metaphor of it being inflationary, like a balloon expanding, because one of the things that has always sort of troubled me is that school curricula are often presented as some kind of linear journey. You know, you start on lesson one and you end on lesson 1500 and you just do them in a linear fashion. But actually, learning is not a linear process at all. And I don't know how well you can see this, but I quite like that it spirals out. I quite like that it extends. So there's thousands of ideas here. Each of these little nodes, if I zoom in, each of these little nodes is a mathematical idea. And then you can see connections between those mathematical ideas. There are sort of arrows here, like coney kind of arrows are showing you wherever that came from. I can't see it off my screen, but wherever that came from, it depends on this thing over here. You'd need to have that in place to begin with. So we've got this full universe of maths. And one of the things that's important in terms of curriculum design for this is, let's say you've got something, I don't know, you've got this thing over here, whatever that is there. In a linear curriculum, that would just come up and it'd be addressed in some way. But in this kind of curriculum, because you know what it's linked to in other parts of the universe, so it's going somewhere quite early. I don't know where it's going, but it's going somewhere very early on in the curriculum through a line down here. And because it knows that, this thing that I learned, whatever it is, something down here that's being encountered, this thing that I learned early on will then be encountered again. But because my schema has been growing, my balloon has been inflating and inflating, when I first learned this, I only knew a tiny part of the maths universe. When I'm meeting this thing again, because it's linked to something later on in the curriculum. When I'm meeting this thing again, I now have a new perspective of it with a much greater mathematical universe around it, so that you can make new meaning about things. And I worry about the idea that learning is linear, that, you know, you do place value and that's it done. Place value is mastered, sorted, finished. I worry about that. It's a very strange view of learning that any idea is ever finished. There's always new perspective. There's always something you can now connect it to because you are growing and you're learning more and more. So all these connections are really important because they bring back to life and perspective on pieces of mathematics that may have been met many years ago, but now you're able to see them in a different way.
What's this? So I've got a few questions on it already anyway. Obviously time is an important thing. Time is an important dimension. You put that in your initial video, and presumably these distances are like the amount of time it takes. Presumably that's different for every child because it's a function of a lot of stuff happening in that child's world, right, as well?
Yeah, it's all children learn at different rates. The differences between learning rates are not as vast as you might think, but they do learn at different rates. Imagine the center of the universe here, and you've got a completely deflated balloon, and then you blow that balloon up and up and up and up. What this map is saying, so there are no timelines on this. It's not saying that this takes 5 days or anything like that. What this map is saying is that a child will begin with a schema that is completely compact, where they don't have any mathematical knowledge. And what happens is over their time of learning mathematics, their mathematical schema grows and grows and grows and grows, and they start to assimilate new knowledge. So what this is saying is that at some point, all children can have a complete schema. At some point, all children can have their balloon blown up completely. And that'll take a different amount of time for different children because they learn at different rates. But as I said, it's not a huge difference. If I just change this into a different dimension, so you can see here it's in this spherical view of the universe. If I just change this slightly, so the universe will just rearrange itself now.
So those were, I mean, to use math speak, that was like a polar coordinate system, and you're going into a different coordinate system? Or?
Yeah, so what you were seeing was kind of radial, and now what we've got here is time being represented in a different way. So you can see down here the spiral's beginning. So this is the beginning of time, and this is the outer reaches of the sphere. So those outer reaches of the sphere would be out here now, and these are the inner workings of the sphere. So what you can maybe see is a kind of spiraling up through all of this, and you can see it kind of tearing. There are tears to it. And what we do, the metric we use is a metric called maths age. And if I just have this view, so at the moment the colors you're seeing represent different didactical areas of mathematics. But if I give the colors a different focus and put them as, sorry, I clicked the wrong thing, put them as maths age. What you'll see here is maths age goes from green is the least mature, and then it goes to the darker and darker colors as it becomes mature. So as mathematical maturation is occurring, you've got these green shoots here, and they're growing stronger and stronger and stronger as you go out. So if we put that back to the inflationary model, then you'll see that the outer reaches of the universe are the darker colors, and the inner parts of the universe are the lighter colors. So there's this process of mathematical maturation occurring as you go through this universe as well. Just switch that back on.
So it'd be very useful for just to get like a concrete example of the core of the universe. I'm assuming that's like ordinality, cardinality, number work, counting, number bonds, etc.
And then Yeah, there will be things like that in that. So there'll be things like, you know, if you go into the early, whoa, it's quite hard to control this on the Zoom.
Yeah, on screen share, yeah. We can obviously just, if you can't show it, that you can just talk about it and like the, where the core of the universe is, and yeah.
So for example here, this is quite early on, right? It's not at the earliest stages, but counting forward and backwards to tech is quite an early idea in mathematics. And there'll be things like one more, one less, and so on. So in the early areas, the purple colors are generally related to numbery kind of activities, things to do with numerosity and so on. And you can see the early universe is populated with quite a lot of number, but also quite a lot of this green stuff, which is geometry, shape and space, sense of measure and so on. And then as you grow out and out and out of the universe, you'll see that number starts to give way to higher level things. And if we go all the way out, we'll end up finding things like calculus and stuff like that. So here, these red ones here, I think are calculus. Whoa. Okay. It's very hard to control.
Yeah, it's a little bit more jerky online, but if you can make it work, that's great. But if not, yeah, we can either you can just mention it. But you've certainly got a video out there already, 15-minute demo, so people can watch that. I'll link that in at the end of this chat.
Yeah, I'm going to do a bit more on that as well, because people have been asking specific questions about it. So I might do another video too.
Yeah, it's very popular. Mark Evans is asking, he's on Twitter as well right now, is the mathematical universe accessible somewhere? Presumably, I think it means to the public or complete maths. I'm not sure, but yeah, but just asking, is it accessible anyway?
Yeah, that's a good question. So let me just load up complete maths. That's come up quite a lot as to what does it look like when we share it with people, because people don't see this. What they see is a linear version of it. So everyone that is a complete maths member, all complete maths members have this full universe. They have the whole thing, they have all the prerequisites and everything that's tagged in there and whatever. It's just they see it in a slightly different way. So I think I have to share my screen differently. How do I do this?
Yeah, that's it, yeah. So you can, it's unshared, so then you can open up the tab where you have the complete maths platform. I'm on the complete maths platform, so I know what you mean, but it's just to show. Show our viewers.
It's this one. Am I showing that?
Yes, Maths Const 22. I was there.
So, in complete maths, rather than it being that crazy map, it looks like this. So, we had to find a way, because teachers are so used to working in this kind of linear fashion, we had to find a way of trying to communicate it in a way that teachers would understand. So all of those little nodes, those little granules that exist, they're sitting in here in this almost linear representation. Each of these things here is one of these little nodes. So yes, it is available. People don't have access to the version that I was showing earlier, the map version of it. But they have access to the linear version of it. Now, how do I stop sharing my screen?
That's fine. Yeah, we can. I think we got the gist of it. Unless you wanna show some more.
No, have I stopped sharing? I don't know.
Yeah, you've stopped sharing. Yeah, if you just hit the share thing and the bottom of the icon, and yeah, for some reason your camera goes off when you share screen, but you could just switch that on again. On the bottom left menu.
Yeah, it's my first time on Zoom.
No, that's fine. Yeah, it's a lot of people are using Zoom now, so it's kind of rescued a lot of businesses actually. So it's a very powerful piece of software.
So I think my screen is back up.
Yes. Yeah, we got the radial inwards.
Yeah. So yeah. That's a little bit about our map and what it does.
That's beautiful. And Catherine's come up with a follow-up question based on the mathematical universe, which you sort of answered earlier. Is with the idea that maths is a universe and interconnected like this, how would you envisage the mathematical universe helping us in curriculum planning, because that is necessarily linear?
I don't think it is linear. I don't think curriculum planning is linear at all. So the one I was just showing you in Complete Maths, where it looks like a linear scheme, it's absolutely not linear. It is this same universe. So what's happening there is that there are lots and lots of spirals going on in that ostensibly linear looking curriculum. There are loads of spirals happening, and those spirals know all of these connections that are shown in this map here. So they are drawing in content at the right intervals and the right moment. They're drawing back content from earlier on in the curriculum or to related parts in the curriculum. So I think it's a perfectly possible thing to do. Once you have the map, it's then a case of like an inflating balloon. That's the journey through the curriculum. The curriculum journey is not a linear thing in this map. You're following this spiral out, and the balloon is inflating, and more ideas are starting to exist on the surface of your balloon as it's inflating, and they're being linked together. These interconnected webs of ideas in maths, super important to get that right. And you know, moving away from the idea that we teach discrete items in mathematics, discrete objectives and so on. You know, and the way we look at that in what we do is, so we use this phrase didactics, which is used in different ways in different parts of the world. We have a view of mathematics as you are learning some pretty big things through your encounter of all these different lessons that you have. So for example, you know, people will have things like, maybe teachers plan a lesson on how to add a fraction. Whereas the way we view it is you're learning about fractionness. And you're learning about fractionness for a really long time, all the way through your curriculum. It appears in lots of different places. So I could find an area of mathematics and then just drag it out or highlight it. So my computer's running really slow now.
Yeah,
it's not a happy problem.
Yeah, it's very RAM intensive. So this kind of there's like a preparation around getting stuff right. But we'll see what it can do. And if not, we can just switch back to video and kind of
let's take questions. A group. So hopefully that's there. You go. So you see them. Hopefully you've just seen the map has completely changed. So this what you're seeing now is a bigger idea. So this is a sense of measure. Now, teachers don't really plan curricula in this way. They plan distinct lessons. What I'm saying is, over your entire time of learning mathematics, I want you to get a sense of measure or a sense of fractionness, or what is exponentiation and how does exponentiation develop over time? So these bigger ideas, which is what my new book is about, Teach Do Practice Behave, is about these bigger ideas and how these ideas evolve over the whole of time at school, so that we're focusing, instead of distinct lessons, we're focusing on big mathematical ideas maturing over time, being connected, being viewed in new ways from different perspectives as you learn more and more things. I don't think it is necessary that schools have to plan in a linear way at all. I've certainly never done that. It's always, you know, I've always taken this very old mastery approach. I've always taken this approach, and this is about these interconnected webs of ideas maturing over time, and they keep reappearing. In a document, it has to look linear because you need a way of being able to read the document. But it isn't linear. I would suggest that there's no need for it.
Right. Yeah. Just an example I'm doing with a 2T parent, just doing very early number work with a teenager actually, sort of suspected dyscalculia, and I've been doing Cuisenaire work with numbers, but I've also been doing geometry at the same time. And the parents asking, well, how are the two linked, or what's happening? And again, this to me really clarifies that these are different ideas that will come together at some point, and then strengthen the strength of connections and understanding of both the ideas. And then obviously we never stop learning stuff, right? You never, one of your quotes that I absolutely love, you never become truly truly expert. You just your knowledge is just increasing, and the number of nodes are increasing.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's and it'd be really depressing, wouldn't it, if you stopped learning? It'd be awful. It's, I really don't understand that idea. One of my big bugbears at the moment are people that have these mastery indicator questions. So if you do that question, boom, you've mastered it. Now, it's just bullshit. It means all that means is that at that particular moment in time, you can answer that question. That's all it means. The idea that because you could answer that question, you have now mastered something as profound as fractions is bonkers. You could take any piece of mathematics. You could take counting, say, right? In early years and in year one, we're trying to get children to get a sense of how counting might work, but also in first year undergraduate maths degrees, we're trying to get our undergraduates to understand the pigeonhole principle. And the pigeonhole principle is counting. It's the same idea. It's the same concept. You could have an entire maths education that was just about counting. That'd be the only idea. And you could easily spend 13 years learning about counting and not get to the end of learning about counting easily. So this that notion of, if you can do this question today, boom, that's it, you've mastered that. It's so reductionist, it's so ridiculous. Anyway, don't get me started on
You
that.
are, yeah, you're never done with that. Yeah, so I'm gonna try and wrap this up. There's loads of questions coming up, actually. Unfortunately, we're not able to answer them live, but I'm sure you can pick them up on the Twitter chat itself, because they're at replies to both me and you. Just kind of segueing from this as well, like another thing I learned from you is you mentioned that the performance is not learning, and how can you like get a gauge of when learning's happened? Because we know in some ways, like because the GCSEs have been cancelled or postponed, like the whole performance aspect is lost. So if you could just elaborate on that sort of difference between performance and learning. I know I've read it in your book, and the allure of performance is always ever present. But how is that different to learning? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, performance, not only is performance very different to learning, but it's not even a good proxy for learning. Being able to do something, if someone tells you something and then 20 minutes you can do that thing, well, anyone could do that. A trained monkey could do that. You just show someone and then they're just regurgitating what you showed them. It doesn't mean you learned anything. It doesn't mean anything at all has been embedded or understood or connected to other ideas. It just means you're regurgitating, replicating, mimicking what you've just seen. And obviously, the trouble is that, after 1994, when the inspection model and the regulatory model changed so much, we created a system where performance is rewarded and learning is ignored. And you'll get people who have become obsessed with every single lesson is the unit of learning. So in every single lesson, you need to make progress. In every single lesson, there needs to be a starter and a plenary, because I don't know. It's hard to source. Like, you can source lots of things, like you can source where the three-part lesson came from and stuff like that. But it's hard to source the imbecile who put forward the idea that every mathematical concept is learnt in precisely 1 hour. Yet this common practice across the country that lessons are treated as, you must come into the lesson, and then there's going to be an experience, and at the end of the lesson you have a plenary because you've now learnt that thing, and then we can move on. That thing doesn't matter anymore. We'll move on to the next thing. It's beyond moronic to believe that. But that is what's rewarded. It's re what's rewarded by not so much inspection, nowadays, very, very much in Spectrum during the 2000s, but definitely by lots of school management teams. That I still see lots of school managers walk in and try and observe a maths lesson, and their criteria is, do the children get lots of questions right? Do the children answer lots of questions and get things right? And if they do, the senior manager walks away and they're all really happy about it. But they might not have learned anything at all. Yeah. So the reward there for the teacher is thumbs up, all your children got 20 questions right, and not a proper forensic investigation of, are these children learning anything at all? And that's why I think we need to be talking about bigger ideas that are learnt over time, not one-off lessons. Lessons are not good. They're not very good units of learning at all. But if you take ideas, these larger ideas, you know, like exponentiation is an idea, fractionness is an idea, numberness is an idea, equality is an idea. You know, if you take these ideas, what you can kind of map out is a period of maturation of those ideas and how those ideas develop as you integrate more and more understanding about mathematics and other subject areas as well in general learning. As you grow as someone who is becoming learned, these ideas do have maturation. And this is true of all learning, right? If you speak to someone who's been teaching 1 year and you ask them about the pedagogic choices they're making in lessons, or you try and watch them and see these pedagogic choices, they're very different to someone who's been teaching 30 years. And it's not that the person in their first year is a bad person and should know more. It's just that learning requires maturation, that it's not possible for that person in their first year to have experienced all of this, all of these connections and these experiences yet. So I think it's the same with mathematics. You know, what does equality mean? Well, if you take someone's immature understanding of equality, that would be very different to someone who has a very advanced and well-connected schema of mathematical understanding. They'll talk about equality, the same idea, one idea, but they'll talk about it in very different ways to each other. And there are conversations you can have with children that reveal to you where they're at in their maturation, reveal to you how they're coming along and what things are being developed, maybe what things you have to tweak, where you've gone wrong as a teacher, what other models you might have to try to expose them to, and so on. These are really hard things to discern on exam paper. An exam paper is very, very limited in what it can do. And you know, a lot of math teachers will remember that the exam paper used to play a part. And then another large part of that was extended pieces of work and was teacher judgments and so on, because we were looking at things far more nuanced than an exam paper can pick up. And I know, you know, I often get kickback about this because people will say, well, you've got an old-fashioned view of the exam papers. Nowadays, the exam papers are sophisticated problem-solving papers. But they're not. They're just not. They are trivial, uninteresting to the mathematician, uninteresting tasks to perform on. And that's okay, because technique is really important, and being fluent in a range of techniques and being able to deploy techniques that you have truly understood onto unfamiliar circumstances and unfamiliar problems is a really important part of the toolkit for the mathematician. But I've never seen an exam paper that is working out whether someone is maturing mathematically. Those things don't tend to exist. So how might you work that out? How might you work out if a child is maturing mathematically? Well, there are people who can do that. They're called really good teachers. Really good teachers can spot that. They know the questions to ask. They know the conversations to have. They know the didactical, the technical details of mathematical ideas and how they evolve over time. So they know that when these things will start to emerge. You know, it can be the early years teacher who knows particular behaviors to be looking out for, and they give you developmental cues. You know, it's cueing you to say this child is starting to develop in this way. But that's also true of the teenager. That's also true of anyone learning mathematics at any stage. You can see where they're at. You teach a bunch of third year undergraduates on a maths course, teach them the Lorentz contraction and watch their little faces. You know, as the there'll be a bunch of them who they've got to that point where actually now that you're stood in front of them telling them that time and space are relative and they can both change their dimensions, some of them will go, yeah, this kind of makes sense. It's logical. I can assimilate that into my schema. And then the rest of them will go, what the fuck are you talking about? And it's like, what on earth is going on? Because they're not able to assimilate that into their schema. And as someone teaching the Lorentz contraction or someone who's teaching ordinality, you need to know what those developmental cues are. And that has a very big implication for teacher training, a very big implication for teacher development, because teacher training doesn't do that. It doesn't get you ready to talk about someone maturing as a mathematician over a long period of time, what that journey looks like and what developmental cues there are and what stages there are as that happens. There's a big need for us to do that. Instead, what we've done is create a system that is about performance in time instead of learning over time. You know, if you need practical ways of trying to spot learning, which is a really hard thing to do, well, there are ways you can do that. There are tasks you can put together. You don't have to put together tasks, actually. You know, every great mathematical task that you need has already been written, right? You know,
right.
Go download the red box or something. You know, you won't do better. You won't create something better.
Right.
These tasks already exist. And there are tasks, very, very carefully designed tasks, which connect lots of webs of mathematical ideas that reveal to you, is true learning happening here? Are they able to, this thing I refer to as far transfer a lot, are they able to take mathematical ideas and techniques and understanding skills, repeatable actions, repeatable knowledge, are they able to take those things and in novel situations they've not encountered before, at a period of in time that is undefined, it is some period in time far away from when they maybe met these techniques, are they then able to use those techniques like tools? Are they then able to deploy them? That's the kind of things we can be looking out for. And when you see, I go around the country, I watch a lot of people teaching. When you see really expert maths teachers, you see them doing that a lot. They're completely uninterested in performance in the moment. Of course, you know, we're trying to give children practice and we're giving them questions in order to promote automaticity, to promote a confidence, a mathematical confidence from confirming their ideas and confirming their thoughts by working on tasks and working on problems. But really expert teachers, you see them doing so much more than that. They understand the connections, they understand maturation, and they understand how to put tasks in place to spot learning. Trouble is, those lessons look insane. They don't look tidy. They don't look like, you know, 30 children sitting in a row doing an exercise of 50 questions. They don't look like that. They look bonkers. And a lot of the time when children are doing mathematics, if they're doing mathematics properly, if they're being mathematical, you know, properly being mathematical, properly doing something demanding, for a lot of their time, what children look like is really confused and struggling and fighting. They look like they're doing something hard. And we've created a system, partly through inspection, partly through school management, and partly through teacher training. We've created a system that penalizes those lessons, that says, whoa, hang on a minute, the children for 10 minutes, they were just thinking. They could have answered 10 questions in that time. And, you know, we've moved away from being, in some places, we've moved away from being an intellectual profession where we used to look at each other's practices and we used to experiment with each other and watch children learning and thinking, understanding that learning takes a really long time. It's okay if a child doesn't learn anything for 5 lessons. That's okay. It's perfectly all right. You know, the people that promoted the idea of progress every 20 minutes, you know, which, you know, Ofsted promoted that, and some head teachers still do promote that. You've got no right working in the school if you think every 20 minutes there should be progress, because you have no understanding of how learning works. You could learn nothing for weeks and then boom, there you go. There it is. There are the connections. It all slots into place. Mm. Amazing. Also, you could grip something and you could become really quite confident with a technique and idea, and you can forget it and you can regress, and that's okay as well. These are perfectly normal, natural things. And watching that bigger picture, watching what's going on, is what we ought to be doing as a profession, instead of saying, are they all busy? Are they all answering questions? Did they all get 50 ticks in their book? No, I'm not sure if that answered that question.
Yeah, no, it's there's a lot of stuff in there, actually. I mean, what I do with tutoring is often deal with parents' anxieties, and it's like, if we could show progress, that's a good thing. But it's not as black and white as that, as you say. It can be many, many, many sessions before you see anything, and suddenly it clicks and it's all in place, or it might happen immediately. It's very difficult to actually really, really, truly measure that. But you know, I completely understand how teachers feel about this, because we're accountable to the system, we're accountable to someone, and that kind of progress has to be shown somehow to the system, and because of that,
I don't agree. I don't agree at all. I think that's the lie that the profession has bought into and believes. If you give children a really, really, really good mathematical education, ignore all the other crap. Just ignore all of it. Ignore all the silly demands. Ignore all of it. And you just teach children mathematics really well and give them an incredibly deep, interesting, inspiring mathematical education, and then put them into a GCSE maths exam, they'll walk it. They'll absolutely walk it. You know, we spend far too much time concentrating on these criteria that we're supposed to tick off, and expectations and all that. Don't worry about it. Just teach children maths really, really well, and the GCSE exam, the A-level exam, they become a doll. But that isn't happening. So much curriculum time is being spent on, pleasing bean counters. People are trying to measure things constantly. So much time is invested on this measurement. Well, if you spent all of that time that you're spending on trying to please the bean counters, thinking about pedagogic choice, thinking about mathematics, thinking about connections between ideas, teaching children really, really properly and securely and deeply, the exams are okay. And, you know, if you're a maths teacher, no one's going to sack you, so don't worry about it. So you'll be all right. There's currently, obviously all the schools are closed at the moment, but before the schools closed, one in every seven maths lessons in England's secondary schools had no maths teacher at all. So, you know, we're going to be okay. Maybe we should take a Hippocratic oath as teachers. Maybe we should take an oath to say, what I'm going to do is teach children my subject really, really well, and everything else doesn't count. That's what I'm going to do. Now, I think a Hippocratic oath for teachers would be a very good thing to do, and stop a lot of the knee-jerk reactions, stop a lot of the cyclical nature of initiatives. If teachers signed up to it and they said, the only thing that matters to me is making a child learn it, making them love my subject, making them really understand it in all of its beauty and color and reach, I think that might be a better place to be in. And I know, I know that there has been a culture of fear created to stop that happening. A lot of teachers say, but I've got to pay my mortgage, and I'm in fear of my job and all that kind of stuff. It's 350,000 people teach maths in England. I promise you, if you all rise up together and you all say, this is what we're going to do, no one's going to mess with you. They really aren't. It's a phenomenal profession, a very, very powerful profession. If we could get back to our core beliefs and our core principles and bat for what we really think is important. Anyway, I'm ranting again.
No, it's fantastic. I mean, this is a great way to kind of wrap up as well. It's the network you've created is, in some ways, you know, I know you at MathsCons, you said, if every teacher knew each other personally, then we would start doing the things that you're mentioning, basically, because you could have that kind of united front, because the maths teachers know how best to teach maths. We like teaching maths. We know. If we can just get that confidence within ourselves as a system and sort of fight the system, so to speak, or do what's right. And if you could just mention how people can join the Complete Maths Network, what's available in the platform, like how to get involved, etc. Because I know there's still a lot of people who are not part of Complete Maths in LaSalle, and that'd be great as well.
So Complete Maths is just the name of our club, really. It has three strands. So we have this full mastery curriculum in the way that we've just looked at, and that gives you everything you need to teach, learn, assess, monitor, track mathematics. So it's an all-through scheme. It goes from preschool, so kind of numberness, the kind of stuff you'd have in the early learning goals, and then it goes through to post-16. And post A-level maths, so it covers the whole thing, and we have loads and loads of schools that use that. And then we also do run our network events. MathsConf is the biggest one. The idea is, what we're trying to do is to create the largest network of maths teachers that has ever existed. What we have at the moment is the largest network of maths teachers in the country, but I still remember back to the days of things like the Nuffield teacher centres, where in every local authority, every half term or so, pretty much every maths teacher was able to come together. So maths teachers are not networking anywhere near as much as they were in the 1980s. And I know people say, you know, they're networking more because of Twitter. It's just not true. Yes, there are lots of people on Twitter and lots of people networking, and that's wonderful. But we used to come together in an organized way of collaboration. Through local authority teacher centres, and through centres, and through Cockcroft missionary centres, and so on. And that's kind of what we're trying to do. We're trying to build up an organised way of the entire community of maths teachers coming together and learning together. So the learning part then comes from, we run the most extensive programme of teacher professional development in the country. We trained more maths teachers last year than any other organisation, and we'll continue to do that. We learn loads from meeting all of our members as well. So we're across the UK and we're around the world as well. We have lots of schools around the world. So if you're not a member of that club yet, why the hell not? What's wrong with you? So come and join us and be a part of that club. The reason I set up, the reason I've spent so much time and effort trying to create this, is because I do genuinely believe that if we all knew each other and we all were willing to help each other out and talk to each other and back each other, we could be amazing. This profession could really get back on its professional feet and really be powerful again and really drive what matters in mathematics education, rather than what has happened in the last 20 years in particular, that the profession has to respond to whim and the profession has to do as it's told. But if we could all come together and we could all share professional thinking, we could all share what we're doing and help each other out, we could take back the debate, and we could start pushing things forward that we know make a real difference to real children in real classrooms. So that's why we do it. The more of us that get together, I think, the better. So we're going to keep building that network as much as we possibly can.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of the LaSalle. It's changed my teaching completely, and just the number of connections I made with people. It's phenomenal. I highly, highly recommend it. And so yeah, we're just gonna wrap up there. There's loads of conversations going on Twitter, actually. It's like I'm struggling to keep track of it, but the comments will be there, the video will be there. So just yeah, thanks for everyone who's tuned in, asked questions. We weren't able to answer every question, but we'll come back and answer as many as we can. And you know, I'd like to do more of this with other teachers, other tutors. Just we can do like a group Zoom call, a small one or a large one. We can live stream it on Twitter. The best thing we can do is like support each other in these times and try and figure out what to do. And you know, by coming on here, Mark, you've just given us quite a lot of hope and just given us that kind of grounding in these very uncertain times. So that's great. Thank you so much for coming along, Mark. I'll just end the live stream and then we'll have a chat for like a couple of minutes and then we can finish up there as well. So yeah, thanks again, Mark. Cheers.
Thanks very much, Russell. It's a pleasure.